We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, I'm Brandon Perna, host of That's Good Sports, a 10-minute-ish daily NFL comedy podcast. Have you ever wished for a crappy version of The Daily Show, but only about the NFL? Then, first and foremost, I implore you to dream much bigger. Secondly, I would recommend subscribing to That's Good Sports. Every weekday, I will be giving you NFL news, telling questionable jokes, and swearing just enough so you won't ever be able to listen with your kids in the room or car. I don't ask for a lot, but if you don't subscribe on iTunes, my wife said she will leave me. Thanks, and I look forward to putting my voice in your ear holes.
What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores and the games every day. Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment.
I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, Laker fans? Welcome to the Laker Film Room Podcast, brought to you by the Blue Wire Podcast Network. I'm Pete, joined as always by Darius. And today we have a very special guest. I believe it's his third time on the pod. It's always great having him. He, for my money, is the best sideline reporter in the NBA, going into his 12th season with the Lakers. He has not aged a day in that time. The one and only Mike Trudell. How you doing, man?
Oh, it is a pleasure to be joined by you guys. You know that I'm a fan of you both for the work that you do. And you also happen to be nice guys, so everybody wins that way. Thank you for the kind intro, man. I'm excited to get going talking about this.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, this is the last week we've got. We got training camp starting on Saturday. LeBron's training camp, his private player camp, has allegedly already started. We got media day on Friday, so this will be the last episode we do until we have actual basketball to talk about. But what we're going to...
It's been a long summer, guys.
Bro. How have you filled that time, Mike?
In many ways, but I am just ready to watch some basketball and stop thinking about it. And, you know, we'll keep thinking about it, but really, like, let's just get to the camp. I've been very anxious to get rolling here.
Absolutely. And, along those lines, we have a new coach in Lakerland in Frank Vogel. Mike did an amazing interview with him, very extensive. It's over at Lakers.com, titled Getting to Know Frank Vogel. And in that vein, it's one thing, you know, from our perspective, Mike, to read it, but from your interview with him and just other experiences that you've had with Vogel, just in a broad sense, what are your impressions on just what kind of guy is he?
Well, the thing that impressed me the most, I think, after spending some time with Frank Vogel was, if you think about his basketball path, it's one that's filled not just with hard work, but also some real ingenuity and some thought and some kind of finding out ways to get himself in. And that in its own right takes a lot of personal skills. And I think he's got that in spades. So you mix that element that he has from the personal side and his ability to get to know people and to be liked by people and to be a positive general person and influence, and then all of the hard work that came from the film room starting at the University of Kentucky. And, you know, I hadn't really heard his story But the real quick nutshell of it is that he played in D3 basketball through his junior year, and he decided he watched the 1992 East Regional Final. We all remember it, of course, as the Christian Leitner shot game. You know, perhaps the best college basketball game of all time. And, you know, I don't know, I guess Magic and Bird might have a word, but some, but it's up there. And he says to himself, I have to go and just jumpstart my coaching career. So he finds his way to coaching at the five-star basketball camp, basically by saying, oh, I can't wait to come back and volunteer for this. And essentially gets Howard Garfinkel to introduce him to Rick Pitino, who he knew would be there as scouting players, essentially. And he also meets Jim O'Brien, and this is going to end up being a real fruitful relationship. But he basically quits. He transfers schools to Kentucky without a promise to do anything, and just finds his way through work and guile and pounding on the relationships to essentially become a student manager. He then learns, again, a great tip by Jim O'Brien, that all the NBA teams are going to be looking for people that can break down film. And he teaches himself, alongside with the help of O'Brien, to do that. And that really forms the basis of his career and where he is today. Because Pitino goes to the Celtics 3 years later. He brings Vogel as the video coordinator. And from that point on, guys, it's just, it's a very clear arc of him doing really well, doing all the right things, working his butt off, and then getting promoted. And that's how he got into the business. And it's, I thought of you actually some, Pete, and you too, Darius, just thinking of all the time that you guys spend doing, watching basketball, just watching film, figuring out how to do this. And Vogel was able to do that and then leverage it into this career on in the coaching side. And I just thought that was a really cool entry level thinking into who he is and what he's about in terms of basketball.
I thought the story about him basically finessing his way into the five-star camp. And and I just thought that was just a brilliant turn by him to get really some face time with Rick Pitino and ultimately with Jim O'Brien. It's really just an amazing story. The other thing that I found amazing, which was a story that I had never heard, was him escaping from his childhood home that was on fire.
Yes.
And that was just an amazing story. And I can't believe that that's not sort of this legend that has traveled with him throughout his NBA coaching career. I think it speaks a lot about sort of this personal character and how he said that it impacted him in terms of teaching him life lessons. Did you sort of get that impression that that's something that he carries with himself every day now, and how it sort of informs the way that he even coaches and lives his life generally?
You know, so the funny thing is that story actually is on his Wikipedia page, as I'm doing all of this crack research, the excellent Joey Ramirez actually tipped me off to this story, and he's like, hey, that's one thing you might want to ask about the fire. And then I was going through his Wikipedia, and sure enough, it's on there. And it is a crazy thing. I mean, he's 17, he's a senior in high school, and he just wakes up to the smoke, yells out to alert his mom, and they end up having to climb out separate windows on the upper floor of the house. And I think it did, you know, teach him some of those lessons. I want to say he referenced one of the Latin phrases. I don't know if it was, carpe diem. I think probably live your life to the fullest. And then the other thing it did teach him, though, at least I got this translated essentially, was to be a risk taker. And that was what he did by leaving pre-med and D3 instead of it being in that vein and sort of just staying in that track. He felt like it was going to be hard to get out of it if he didn't. And he just up and left all of it, went to Lexington, and essentially talked his way right onto the, just like he did in the Garfinkel, he basically talked his way onto the staff. And it sounds like cavalier, but really, I think it tells you something, because imagine how many players around the country and just how many of us that loved basketball in college. Rick Pitino was the guy then. Like, everybody was trying to get that spot. Everybody in the country was trying to get the student manager job for Rick Pitino. I mean, imagine if you think about the intramural games that are going on at Kentucky, a big university like that, where all they care about in the state is college basketball. And he found a way to do it, right? And that, to me, that's not about luck. Like, that's a skill. That's a real skill to be able to find your way to do that. And then as he quotes it, and he says it more eloquently than I can, so I won't I won't try to paraphrase it, but like essentially the getting to know someone is the first thing you have to do in the coaching business. But then the work that you put in is how you get the next job. Like that's how you move up the chain. You got to know people, you got to do the handshaking, and you got to find your way to talk yourself into stuff. But it's ultimately about the work. And that's how he ended up progressing his career.
So he's got some interesting people that he's going to have to get to know, and that is in the process of doing that, and that he's going to be working alongside. You know, there are some interesting dynamics, perhaps, with Jason Kidd and Lionel Hollins. He spoke to being excited about that veteran experience on the bench, but you've also got LeBron James. You've got different, you know, various power players within that. And of course, at this point, you know, he's got to say that to everyone, right? That, you know, I'm excited with what I have, and I'm sure he is, but he's going to have some interesting waters to navigate. What are the challenges, Mike, that you think that he's facing, aside from, you know, it's great to have those experienced coaches, but there are perhaps other dynamics at play as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I know there's been a lot of focus this offseason about the coaching staff, and especially just the fact that he's got Jason Kidd on his staff, and then to a lesser degree, Lionel Hollins, experienced head coaches. But aside from Phil Jackson, who was the coach when I came to the Lakers and was already a legend, was always going to have the job as long as he wanted. Aside from that, man, you have to just win. Or I don't care what the dynamics are. I don't care who the assistant coaches are. If you are with the Lakers and you have LeBron James and Anthony Davis and a bunch of shooting around it, he is ultimately going to just be judged by that. So I think it's much less of a thing, whatever the dynamics between the coaching staffs and like, because all of that was understood when Vogel took the job. So I'm not sure, maybe Darius, I'm underplaying it too much, but I just think that this is a results thing when you have this roster and this management, and the Lakers have not won in the previous several years. That to me is going to define all of this. And it's really pretty simple in terms of Vogel or anybody that was going to take this job.
Yeah, I think the idea of pressure. So Vogel, the one thing that impressed me during the whole Frank Vogel interview process and then the aftermath of his introductory press conference was he came off super polished and experienced and someone who had been around the block and sort of knew how to maneuver with the media and how to pivot when necessary, how to be upfront and honest while not being so transparent that he was giving too much away. And I think that's going to serve him well within this job. I think you're spot on, Mike, in terms of how winning is really going to dictate the narrative around things. I also think that, you know, as someone who is close to the team, but also has a media aspect to your job as well, that outside narratives are going to try to push themselves in to this regardless of win-loss record. And do you actually think that any of that is going to be able to penetrate the story, even if he is winning at a good enough clip where you would think that he would be able to keep some of that outside noise out?
Yeah, so I want to be careful not to dismiss that there are elements right at play there, especially with the Lakers. But this is an NBA head coaching job. They're even in the smallest market, and he was just in one of them in Orlando or another one in Indiana. Even in those type of places, now the NBA and NBA Twitter and fans, we are all so much more educated that this stuff is going to get talked about. There are going to be distractions and outside storylines, period. I don't care what the market is. I don't care if you have stars or not. I mean, look at Kokoschkov in Phoenix last year, lasted 1 year. There was no focus there at all. Not really many media narratives. And then all of a sudden you have a change in some aspect in the front office. And then, you know, he gets fired and in comes Monty Williams. Vogel is a victim essentially of regime change in Orlando, where they bring the Bucks staff, upper management staff down there. So that stuff is going to happen in the NBA. And Vogel, Darius, I thought you handled this point really well. He just really gets all that. So he's cool. Like, he's calm. When you go and talk to him about this, he gets what it is, I think, he gets what the Lakers are. He gets what the brand is. He gets what the media focus is going to be. He gets what happens around LeBron James. He gets that stuff because it does seem like the three of us, we're obsessed basketball fans. We get that. And Vogel has been in the NBA, like in various head coaching jobs and assistant coaching jobs and scouting jobs and advanced scouting jobs, all of that stuff. He's just seen it all. So you're not going to phase him by that stuff is I guess my central point.
You know, it's great to have a coach that has that type of experience that is going to be unfazed by that. And to your point, like, you know, there's only 30 of those jobs and it's a hyper competitive industry. So in LA, it's probably impossible, unless you're a Phil Jackson, like you said, to be able to avoid that dynamic. And so now he comes to this team that has had a great deal of roster change from one year to the next. It has Anthony Davis in the fold, a lot of new guys with Danny Green. You know, we could go down the list, but we know how different the construct of this team is. By my count, there are only three guys that are guaranteed to start, and that's LeBron, AD, and Danny Green. Beyond that, you've got, you know, a positional battle at the center spot, and then even more so perhaps at the point guard position. And that's where I want to focus now. Like, in my eyes, the Lakers have a lot of guards that, especially with LeBron as, and there's a section of your interview with Vogel that covers this, LeBron's going to be the primary ball handler, regardless of who starts at the one. And even if, you know, you had a high end one, he's still going to be the primary ball handler.
Are you breaking news here?
I don't think so. No. I think this is year 18 of that. I think this is a pretty safe bet.
It was treated like that this summer. I just thought that was the whole thing was funny. And Vogel kind of had a chuckle about it too, right?
Right. It's so semantical, right? Like, it's this, you know, like, LeBron's going to have the ball. Let's not make this rocket science. So along those lines, the Lakers have a lot of guys that are close together who could make a case for, like, there are any number of four or five guys who could fill that position, from Alex Caruso, Rajon Rondo, Avery Bradley, Quinn Cook. Even KCP is a guy who could defend ones and, you know, fill a spot up need outside of that. So, you know, there's no way of knowing who that's going to be, but what are the elements of individual players' games that you think they should be looking for to fill that position?
So if I can break it down like this, there are two players that I think at this stage of their career still have the two-way ability, and that's going to be Avery Bradley and Alex Caruso. Mm-hmm. Rondo at this stage, you know, probably still more of a playmaker and sort of control the offense, get the team into sets, et cetera. And, you know, and then Quinn Cook, really a bit more of a shooting specialist. We'll see how he does defensively. So towards that end, I would see Bradley and Caruso as the guys that have the chance to, depending on how they play and how they shoot, to play the most minutes. The starting job, just at the beginning of the season, I do feel like that's going to be more of a Bradley-Rondo battle. That's just my read on looking at the roster. But I do think that as they get playing more, the guy that I like, and I know Pete and Darius, you guys have talked about him a lot. I mean, geez, honestly, all Laker fans seemingly since the spring have been talking a lot about Alex Caruso, and I will here too, because I just do think that he fits in some of the two-man plus-minus data last year would suggest the same thing. He fits next to LeBron. He fits as kind of that LeBron point guard of the past that's going to defend, that's going to take charges, that's going to space, that's going to cut to the rim, all of that stuff. But just in terms of him being basically the only young guy on the roster, I guess you could throw Cook into that. I do think that you're going to get the veteran, the kind of the traditional thing in the NBA, especially for a team without much continuity, at that first shot at it. And so that's a long-winded way to answer the question. But I do see initially kind of Rondo, Bradley. We'll see how they're playing. We'll see who's playing better. And then as the year goes on, I wouldn't be surprised to see Caruso, just through sheer basketball, get his way into regardless if it's the starting lineup, but definitely more minutes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I really appreciated you asking Vogel directly and using the plus minus data and lineup data to ask him about the comparison between Rondo and Caruso in terms of playing next to LeBron. And I thought it was interesting that Vogel acknowledged some of the lineup data and how the Rondo-LeBron pairing didn't quite work out last year, but then he pivoted quite quickly to he expected that to be the complete opposite, I believe was the phrase that he used this season. And I was wondering if you had any sort of concerns about that, or if you sort of share some of the coach's optimism, or if you sort of think that that may just be something that he's saying to sort of keep the competition open.
Well, later in the interview, I think right towards the end, I just asked him generally, hey, you've been in the gym. all these guys have been in here. What do you see? And the first thing that he mentioned was basically Rondo was drilling three after three after three. And I thought, okay, that's good and that's interesting. But once the game start, it's that whole conversation. I know you and I, or the three of us, don't have the habit about gravity, the whole like Steph Curry thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the whole thing there. Is it, it what if Rondo is hitting threes consistently, at what point in the season do teams start defending it like they're going to defend Quinn Cook or Jared Dudley or Troy Daniels? You know, these additions that immediately have that kind of career 40% tag on them, where in the scouting report, that's going to be acknowledged by the opponent and therefore is going to create more space for LeBron and Anthony Davis specifically. So that all of that stuff, whatever's going on right now in the gym, shooting, how, you know, Rondo is such a great leader. He's so good behind the scenes. It's impossible, I think, for coaches, and I know there have been exceptions at a couple of stops, but for the most part, when you're around Rondo, you guys heard Luke talk about this all the time last year, it's really hard not to respect and to kind of give him that benefit of the doubt, because he's there, he's so sharp, he's so into it, he's so thinking about how to maximize his teammates, that I do think that they give that stuff a chance, and then we'll just see. Like, we'll be able to tell early in the season, right, if how is that looking? It doesn't matter what it's been like in practice, because even the first two or three games, there's going to be a much better read on that. So I just view it more, Pete, in the kind of the hypothetical right now. And I get why we would want to, the Lakers would want to look at all of these guys and why you would give the benefit of that to somebody because of how much they've impressed you in the building.
So let's take a quick break. And when we get back, I need Mike to talk me down from the ledge. I want to get a little further into the Rondo stuff, because I have questions and I'd love to hear some perspective from someone on the inside like Mike. So let's take a quick break and we'll be right back in a moment. Join the 10 million who've tried Harry's. Claim your special offer by going to harrys.com/bluewire. Harry's founders were two regular guys tired of getting ripped off paying for overpriced razors. Harry's makes quality, durable blades at a fair price, just $2 a blade. If you don't love your shave, let them know and they'll give you a full refund. This summer, refresh your wallet and your face with the Harry's Trial Set. It comes with a weighted ergonomic handle for an easy grip, a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade for a close shave, rich lathering shave gel that'll leave you smelling great, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy on the go. Listeners of the show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/bluewire. Make sure you go to harrys.com/bluewire to redeem your offer and let them know that we sent you to help support the show. And while we're here, at the end of a hard week, it's great to sit down, take some time off, and watch some football. Game-winning touchdowns on two-minute drives, running backs racing down the sidelines with no one to stop them. There's nothing else like the NFL, and there's no better way to make the games even more exciting than to bet on them. So do the smart thing and go to mybookie.ag. No one gives you more ways to win than they do. MyBookie's got the fastest payouts and better lines than any other sportsbook. Don't forget, where you're betting is just as important as who you're betting on, and mybookie.ag is the best in the business. If you're the kind of guy that likes to bet a little and win a lot, try a parlay. If all of your picks come through, you'll multiply your winnings. Join now and MyBookie will double your first deposit. Use promo code BLUEWIRE, that's one word, BLUEWIRE, to activate the offer. That's promo code BLUEWIRE, all one word. Visit mybookie.ag today. You play, you win, you get paid. All right, Mike, so I watch a lot of tape. I'm also a former high school basketball coach. I have no high level experience. These guys are all professionals. So with that caveat, when I watch tape and I watch Rondo, and then the discrepancy between what I see and then what I hear, and not just what I hear, but also the playing time, right? Like, in, I see it enacted, I want to scream, because I see a guy who does not play defense, who, yeah, he shot 36%, but like you said, he doesn't have any gravity, right? I remember that Milwaukee game on March 1st at home, where he shot like 10 threes in the first quarter because nobody was defending him. And he hits those at that like 36% clip, but that has a domino effect on the rest of your offense, right? Because a little more attention is going to be on LeBron, a little more attention is going to be on Anthony Davis. If Rondo beats you shooting threes, you live with it. So my question is what am I missing? You alluded to the behind the scenes stuff, the leadership, but like, it, to me, that's not enough, but I'm also not an NBA level coach. What am I missing that makes there be such a broad discrepancy between what I see and how he's treated by both his coaches and his peers?
Yeah, that's so I think you almost answered the question in the with the question, and it's very difficult to translate that, like, just from watching the games or looking at the data. And that's, again, why we had the whole conversation. It's not that hard to understand why the two-man lineup stuff was that different. Like, if you have Caruso with LeBron, he's playing defense, he's cutting to the hoop, he's not on the ball, therefore LeBron is on the ball more. That's always better. I don't care who the teammate is, right? Now, we'll see about Anthony Davis. That's obviously another good thing to have going for an offense. But so that stuff, I think you're right. That stuff does make sense. It's all pretty clear. But what you don't see from watching, or if you're even I have to almost glean it off a bit from the players and from the coaches, but I can see some of it in the building and just whether it's on the plane, in the hotel, all this kind of stuff. They're just he really does garner respect from his teammates and his coaches, and that does mean something. Now, when that's like, that is why I think he gets some benefit of the doubt. And there's also this whole every coach is going to come in and just want to see it for themselves. How does, and I think Vogel said that almost explicitly in the answer, is it's almost like, yep, you know, I'm aware of what we saw last year. I'm aware of some of the data, but, you know, let's just see how things look with actual spacing, you know, around and all of that stuff. So I know I'm wrapping around a little bit on the answer, but I think that it's not, there isn't going to be, Pete, I'm not going to be able to sell you on that. Right?
Sure,
I'm not trying to. I'm just saying that kind of stuff should be pretty evident once they actually start playing in lineups together. But it also represents the challenge of this team. And a lot of teams in the Western Conference especially have continuity going into the season. You can go up and down. Really, the teams that we expect to make the playoffs, for the most part, with the exception of the Clippers, it's almost the same roster. You just bring in Kawhi and then Paul George once he gets back healthy. Aside from Westbrook, the Rockets are all the same. Portland's wings are different, but the rest of the roster is constructed the same. Denver is almost exactly the same team, and you add a shot blocker in Grant. So the teams that they're going to be competing against are going to have a continuity edge with their coach. They're going to have a continuity edge with the personnel. But what they don't have is potential All-NBA starting first team forwards. And all the rest of this stuff, who's playing point guard in what lineups, and if JaVale starts versus if Dwight does, it still, to me, comes down to the fact that, I really don't think that nationally this is being discussed enough. I mean, this is LeBron James and Anthony Davis playing together. That is an absolutely absurd pairing. And I did this whole thing, like James and Davis, looking at the top NBA duos since 1980 and how many teammates shared the first team. And it had only happened six times, you know, going all the way through that time. And it's some of the players like that you would expect, right? It was Kobe and Shaq did it three times. Jordan and Pippen did it once. Stockton and Malone did it twice. Magic and Kareem twice. And then one time apiece for Bird and McHale. And what was the other one? I think Nash and Stoudemire in 06, 07. So it's going to be difficult, right? You have Giannis, you have Kawhi, but James and Davis are very clearly, to me, two of the best four and probably two of the best three forwards. And like that alone, putting shooting around them is so much more of an important thing than how Vogel distributes the point guard minutes. And if Caruso gets 20 and Bradley gets 20 and Rondo gets 8 or if Rondo gets 15, like that stuff to me is going to get ironed out and has to. But we're going to kill ourselves trying to figure out exactly how the coaches are thinking and approaching that, as opposed to kind of the bigger picture focus.
So if I'm hearing you right, do you think we're overplaying issues at maybe point guard and at center? And I think the center discussion is interesting as well, based off of Anthony Davis's ability to play center a lot. But the Lakers still carrying JaVale McGee and then bringing in Dwight Howard after the DeMarcus Cousins injury. And are we paying too much attention to that? Or because this is a team that is expected to compete for a championship, and you know from following the league for as long as you have and seeing championship teams up close and personal, that all of that work around the margins, when you start to get to the second round of the playoffs, the conference finals, and then the finals, those things matter a great deal. And so are we overrating it at this point based off of the Davis LeBron pairing, or is it something that should be minimized some, but then come playoff time, we may go back to it and say, well, you know what, this really was important?
No, it's so I'm kind of chuckling to myself as you asked that, because it's so the three of us, right? We're going to overthink everything with basketball, because that's we're obsessed with it. We love to watch it, and we're going to take like the way that I think about it. All right. If you've got LeBron James and Anthony Davis, there are very few question marks with that pairing, right? We can agree on that?
Yes.
Okay. So if you now just stay with me here. If you go to Houston, I've got some questions about Westbrook and Harden and how they fit, especially in a playoff game. I've with Utah and with Portland, I've got some questions. If your two best players are guards, right, that typically does not win in the postseason. And that's my concern with Utah, as deep as they are and as solid as they are. You know, Mitchell and Conley, you can just switch LeBron over to them for a key for, you know, like the Derrick Rose effect in Chicago. Same thing that just happened. Lillard can get swallowed up in postseason games by bigger wings, like that kind of stuff. The question marks to the two best players to me are a lot more important than the question marks up and down the roster. But Darius, you're also right in that looking at this roster right now, the biggest question mark is, because it's otherwise Pete would have said at the beginning, well, clearly there are five. We know who the five starters are going to be. Like if that were the case, right, then there wouldn't be that level of concern about who's it going to be. How many minutes is that player going to play? What are the lineups going to be constructed like? Is it going to be a secondary ball handler? Is it going to be a defender and spaced shooter? So it's very much relevant, Darius. It's just that if I'm building my team, the thing that I want the most is nice cohesion between my two stars. And that, on both ends of the floor, to me, the Lakers have an advantage over everybody in the league, in either conference. And so that's all I'm saying. The point guard thing, you're right, yes, but that's what the regular season is for. Figure out the best point guard to start, figure out the best rotation, all of that stuff. But what you don't have to worry about is getting a good shot in the half court, because you have LeBron James and Anthony Davis.
So my hypervigilance, yes, it is in part because I obsess like you guys do about all of this stuff. But it's also because the stakes are completely different than they've been for several years around here, right? It's, you know, I don't think that this is a championship or bust season. I think this can be a successful season outside of that, but I think I'm probably in the minority in believing that. But if that is the end goal, and in a season where there is no Warriors, there is no Heatles with LeBron and Bosh and Wade, there is no clear-cut favorite, I see the championship within the Lakers' grasp, at least. If things break the right way, it's not beyond the realm of possibility at all for that to happen. One of my concerns, and this speaks kind of to a philosophical thing, is that when it comes down to it in those deeper rounds of the playoffs, there are maybe two and a half guys on this team that I trust to be able to fulfill their role on the team when it counts the most. Even Danny Green, who I think is a wonderful player, he was a guy who wasn't even always on the court at the end of games for Toronto last year, being replaced by Fred VanVleet instead, right? And so it's not that I need another star in that third role, but can you do what your job is? Can I trust KCP to be KCP and nothing more, right? But be KCP deep into the playoffs. And that extends to any player on the roster beyond Anthony Davis and LeBron, because I've seen enough times from watching the NBA over the years, guys falling apart when it matters most. And what I don't want is a repeat of some of those LeBron and Cleveland teams where it's like LeBron and Kyrie and everybody else is, you know, kind of falling apart when it matters the most. So to what, I guess, what do we need out of guys 3 through 9? Because like you said, man, this is the best duo in the NBA, because not only are of their individual talent, they fit together. They can vibe off of each other, but we're still going to need those guys 3 through 9. So my question to you, Mike, is what is it that we need from them in order to get to where we want to go?
Well, so the first clear thing in this to bring last year into this discussion, and I think that Rob Pelinka did a really good job of course correcting this, is you got to have the shooting around a duo like that. So that clearly, to me at least, was the priority of the offseason. You signed the best 3-and-D guy that was available in Danny Green, and that immediately fills a need, not just defensively, but with the shooting. You know, 40% career 3-point shooter. I shot 45% last year, right? So that's the first thing that you do. Then you bring in some other shooting. I really like Jared Dudley. I think that he and Kuzma are the two guys, and I think Darius, I either we had the same tweet or you wrote about this and then I did after, and I couldn't remember the order of this, but like when the whole thing about when DeMarcus Cousins went down, that was to me what we were going to see more, right? It was Davis at the five and then Kuzma more on the floor and maybe even Jared Dudley, as opposed to another center that you were going to sign on the waiver wire, which turned out to be Dwight Howard. Like, that to me was the next thing that was really important. Wasn't that part of what you were thinking, Darius?
Yes, it was. Yeah. And I like Dudley a fair amount and Kuzma as well. I wrote about this at Forum Blue and Gold, but that I actually think that they're the perfect type of combo forwards to slot between Davis and LeBron, just based off of their very specific skill sets and how they can complement them in different ways offensively.
And I was super encouraged with the Team USA stuff now with Kuz, and it was a bummer that he hurt the ankle and he didn't actually end up being able to go to China. But he was doing almost exactly what I would have loved to, you know, if you just wrote out a sheet in terms of what do I want him to do around LeBron James and Anthony Davis, that's what Kuz was doing for Popovich in Team USA. He's cutting to the basket. He's rebounding. He's taking open threes, but not off the dribble threes that he had to create or felt like he had to create last year, especially when LeBron and Lonzo and Ingram and everybody went down. He's working as hard as to play defense. Like, he still had some of his weaker points. Like, he would get matched up with a Miles Turner or you know, somebody like that, where it's just a difficult matchup inside in the paint. But other than that, he was doing all of these role player things, but with some swag. And I just think that could be a really nice compliment, especially in those lineups when you get down to it with Kuzma. So, Pete, getting back to what you were asking about and kind of what they're looking for, to me, the whole point guard spot thing, like when you brought in Davis and what you had to give up to get him, and then you had to get Danny Green. And so from that point on, you didn't have all that much money, and there really weren't that many players available, at least in terms of a point guard spot. Like, you saw what Ricky Rubio went to Phoenix for. You know, that was for a lot of money for not that many years. So with that said, as the season goes on now, you see how you can plug that point guard spot. And if the guys on the roster can do it, great. If not, that's when you start to think about whether there's something you can do with the trade deadline or not. But you have what you – I think Pelinka did about as well as he could have to build the roster around that duo. And that gets back a little bit, Pete, to what you said about championship or bust. I think they feel like that, and they're the Lakers, and they're always going to feel like that. But it also does take some time to be able to pick off a piece that fits perfectly, and it's that fifth piece. It's that, you know, it's that I'm trying to think of who that player would have been, you know, because it couldn't have been Lamar because he was the sixth man. But maybe the Shannon Brown and the Jordan Farmar and the guys that just come in for 10, 15 minutes and do the right things. I think they have those guys on the roster. I don't know yet how Vogel's going to utilize him, but I do think that it's like there's enough in the puzzle for him to figure out, and that like there's enough that they can do to compete for it right now. I think they're what, are they second in terms of odds in Vegas?
For sure. I mean, we're right there. There's that, you know, group. I have concerns about continuity. I have concerns about, like, I think we need one more guy. I know you're not at liberty to discuss players on other teams as a Lakers employee, but, you know, as guys possibly become available via buyout or the trade market, Lakers are a little limited in terms of assets of what they can move for that. I think they're one guy away. I don't think that guy needs to be amazing or anything, but that's about where I think the talent level is, because I think that the drop off is a little too severe. I think you've got a lot of those 10 to 15 minute guys, but I think maybe you need a couple more of those 25 to 30 minute guys.
Right. And the next piece of that, though, and I'll kind of throw this back to you, though, Darius, when you're, and this is something Anthony Davis hasn't seen yet, but when Anthony Davis is your second best player, the defense can't do a ton of focusing on the third, fourth, and fifth options. It just, yeah. So all of these guys, the rest, you know, Pete, you mentioned it, 3 through 8, they are, I just promise you, are going to benefit from that. They, like, you have to defend this team a certain way. And this is something I talked about Vogel with off the record, but I kind of asked him, like, hey, how do you defend a LeBron James, Anthony Davis screen roll? Right? It, like, it's, this is, that's the part to me that's interesting too. And maybe one of these guys that we watched that was on the roster last year or that they brought in from somewhere else just looks better because, hey, you know, that you have two top five players on the court.
Yeah, I think the attentiveness that the defense is going to have to play, or pay, I should say, to Davis and LeBron wherever they are on the court, whether they're playing in two-man game together or whether or not it's LeBron at the point of attack and Davis sort of lurking strong side post up or weak side lurking as a lob threat or as an off-ball screener for Danny Green. There is a lot of action that Frank Vogel can build into an offense that almost can serve where the Lakers' best players become decoys of sorts in order to optimize the maybe more limited talents of their teammates. And just like you said, Mike, I do think that players, especially those who are comfortable working in off-ball situations and who have played on high-level teams, and I think that points to a Jared Dudley. I think that points to maybe even a Quinn Cook, that those guys can end up thriving off of the Lakers' superior talent. One thing I wanted to ask you, and it's sort of been something that I've talked about a lot, not only on this podcast with Pete, but with other Lakers fans on Twitter or just in general conversation, is a closing lineup. And do you think consistently we're going to see closing lineups where the front court is actually LeBron, Kuzma, and Davis? And do you think that's going to be a closing lineup staple? Or do you think that Vogel will play a more matchup based where even if they are playing maybe against a Joel Embiid type or a Nikola Jokic or a Karl Anthony Towns, maybe someone who is a strong post presence, that they go to maybe one of the banger centers in order to keep Davis off of that responsibility?
No, so I think that, and this is coming off of just watching a lot of Davis over the years, and I know Pete, you especially just have been watching clips lately, but the beauty of him is that you play him at the five and you don't lose anything in terms of rim protection, and he can also switch out in the perimeter. He basically can do everything. So he's the guy to me. If you think about a seven-game series and a matchup against, say, the Clippers, how are you going to guard Anthony Davis? And because he can guard you, he can either move his feet or he can play off, and then he can still get to the rim and protect the weak side. And guess what? In a seven-game series, so does LeBron. This is what people keep forgetting, I think. Well, okay, maybe I'm overcorrecting here, but LeBron in a playoff series defensively, especially in the third and fourth quarter, is a monster. And you don't want him to do it in November and December and January, but all that athleticism and that instinct and him digging down and him protecting the rim, like that stuff happens too. So if you have those two guys on either side of the court, and then to me, you absolutely will have Kuzma in that group, and then you'll have Danny Green. And in terms of the final spot, to the basic point of, it seems like this podcast, I think we've talked about the most. All right, if it's defensively, is it Caruso maybe? Is it Bradley maybe? Or do you just want that extra spacing from Quinn Cook out there, and who's going to give you the most gravity? So that it's that option, I think, can come into play. Maybe it's KCP on a given night if he's hot on that on a given night. So. But those I do absolutely, Darius, put Kuz into that group. And I think that Davis is the whole key to all of it. And that's in a series. That is a lineup that is really scary to me if I'm an opponent, because you can really do everything on both ends. And I just don't see almost any classic center aside from Joel Embiid, who plays kind of differently. He still a lot of times plays on the perimeter. So I don't see almost anybody else having their big in for crunch time anyway. So you're not going to need that banging. And if a team wants to do that, fine, go ahead. You can. I don't care if you have Kuzma, Davis, or LeBron on that player, or even Jared Dudley. That's fine. If you want to do post ups late, cool. And then we'll just spread you out on the other end.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm working on an Anthony Davis video that should be out this week. You know, I'm watching all of this footage and I'm just like, I almost rushed to Twitter and was like, you guys, Anthony Davis is amazing on defense. Like everybody doesn't know that. But just the degree to which somebody, Dan Bailey said this on Twitter today. He said, he put it perfectly. He said, Anthony Davis at the elbow is a step away from blocking your jump shot and a step away from blocking your shot at the rim. The distance that he covers with both his legs, and he's an ambidextrous shot blocker. He'll block shots with either hand, and his quickness, his ability to hedge high, but still be able to recover and not be beat by guards, ability to switch, all that. It makes me wistful for, I wish he embraced playing the five a little bit more. But I do anticipate that you know, him, it, our best lineups are going to involve him at the five because it neutralizes so much of what you can do. But in the spirit of this being a training camp preview, he's not going to start at the five. And you've got JaVale, and then Dwight was signed later in the offseason. I'm of the mind that if Dwight is caught up enough, if he's in good enough shape coming off of the back injury and all that, he's the guy that makes sense. Because if you're going to put JaVale, like if you don't want AD to absorb punishment and you want a guy to be able to bang with fives, JaVale isn't really a banger himself, right? So maybe JaVale has an advantage. And you pointed this out in a recent mailbag that you did, Mike, in terms of familiarity with LeBron being in with the Lakers for a year. But I think Dwight, off-court stuff aside, is the better fit. How do you see that center battle, you know, for that starting position kind of playing out throughout training camp?
I saw JaVale did an interview with Spectrum the other day, and where he basically said, hey, I started last year. I expect to start, but we'll see. I think I'm going to form a great tandem with Dwight and yada, yada, yada. I would give McGee the edge to start the season, again, just for continuity purposes with LeBron. He played well early in the season. He played well late in the season. He looks to be in great shape. I also think just given what Dwight's the structure of how they brought him in, it just to me, it does make some sense to kind of build that up and to see how he's doing in practice, see how he does in the preseason, et cetera. So I personally would probably give McGee that early edge. But I actually, so just to get back to what you said about Davis quickly in the five, my mission this offseason has been to sort of underplay that in the same way that I'm underplaying the LeBron point guard thing, because he ultimately is absolutely going to play plenty of center in crunch time and especially in situations late, but he's not going to play the start, the first quarter, third quarter center minutes where it does seem to be like that is the time when more teams go up big and bang a little bit more. And which essentially means that he's going to be playing center when it matters, when it's not really playing center, because no teams at that point late in games are really going into the post and banging and necessarily flying at the glass because they're getting back in transition. And it does become much more of an open court game. So I just don't see that being as much of an issue. I think he's going to play there enough. And he said it perfectly in his presser. He's like, look, we all know I prefer to play the four. He went to look at Vogel, but coach, trust me, like when you need me, I'll be playing the five. And that's how it's going to be.
It's interesting. I thought Vogel sort of, he said the quiet part quietly in your interview where he talked about most teams play a shooting center about 50% of the time. So if we were doing an over under for Anthony Davis, do you think he spends over or under 50% of his minutes at center this season?
I still think it would be under. Okay. Just because, again, those first minutes of the half, and then kind of like the second rotation. And again, even if he's like, I just view basketball much more positionless, and I know you guys do as well. And yeah, when he's on the court, even if it's with LeBron or Kuzma or even Jared Dudley, Dudley at times switched on to centers last year in the postseason against Philly. Mm-hmm. From Brooklyn, that's stuff that you can do now, or you can just trap. And you guys are better than I am at all of the language and the various things that you can do defensively. But I'm underplaying it probably again. That's been sort of my theme over since I came to the Lakers, I think, in 2008. But I don't see that as being as central, and no pun intended, because I think that Davis, in the moments where of the game that are really going to matter, he at that position makes the other team not able to play a center, and therefore he's not really playing center even when he is playing center.
I think I followed all of that, and I agree. This is great stuff, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us, man. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Always good to talk to you guys. Hit me up anytime.
For sure. All right. You've been listening to Laker Film Room Podcast. We will catch you guys next time.
Baines has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn his double team. This pass out in front, broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
There's Magic, got it. Magic fires. It's good. And the Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game.
Campbell in and out. The ball is tipped, and it's saved. 3 seconds left. Here's Van Exel. This is for the win. He got it.
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. By Kobe. With his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Lakers. second round for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
in Boston. Of all places.
Are you kidding me? I know Red Auerbach is rolling over.
Kobe. Hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal. Are you kidding me?
How strong was that? A triple on a fall away in the corner with a shot clock down. Lakers by three.
Ryan spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Credit pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
And the critical part was Pierce was jogging back. Didn't bounce the floor. It's a two-for-one situation.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell. There's the move. Two. One.
Miss it.
Bryant.
Bryant. Yes. And that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
That insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that.